Hello and welcome to Dummy, a weekly conversation among editors and friends of Howler magazine. My name is George Qureshi. I'm the editor of Howler and I'm in Tampa, Florida. Bobby Warshaw is back, everybody, and I'm going to get him to tell you where he was in just a minute. Today, Bobby, where are you? Bethesda?
Yeah, Bethesda, Maryland.
Yeah.
Hanging out with my brother and sister and their new little baby.
Oh, that's sweet. That's really sweet. Okay. So, Bobby, tell everybody... I mean, I've been sort of teasing this for the past few weeks, not only just to explain why you're absent from the podcast, but because it's a great story. And we've been sort of going back and forth about how much you want to tell people because you want to write about it. But I want you to just explain where you were and what happened to you and why you're back.
It was totally the experience of a lifetime, the kind of thing that you read about and you say, holy shit, I can't believe that happens in real life. Partially I'm going to write about it, but also I may still go back and sign, or I'm going to try and sign in Israel again in June because it was a good experience, incredible place. You've never been to Israel. So I don't want to like fully divulge all the secrets and like make it weird for the teams that I may or may not sign with.
Yeah.
But essentially like I went to Israel with the expectation of a deal. I showed up and the deal didn't work out and we're there deadline day and like literally up to the second. So I was there with the expectation of signing and having a contract for the rest of the year, and it didn't work out. So I basically stayed around and hung out in Israel, you know, maybe talk to other teams, see if we could work something out in the future. I flew to Israel expecting to sign a contract and ended up having a short vacation.
Yeah, and you were there for like 10 days, right? So
yes, and
with a free place to stay.
Free place to stay right in downtown Tel Aviv, went to the beach. Went to the Tel Aviv Derby, which I'm in the midst of writing about. A wild, wild experience where Hapoel Tel Aviv played Maccabi Tel Aviv. And as we were walking to the stadium, we got swept up into a crowd. And they're chanting and singing. And I'm rocking my fist, totally feeling the energy. And I ask my new Israeli friend next to me what they're saying. And he says, Holocaust to Maccabi. Holocaust to Maccabi. Ooh. And I said, you know what? This is a little too intense for me. I'm just going to back out a second. Try and grab a beer.
did you ever go on like a birthright trip or anything? Like, was that your first trip to Israel?
Nothing, which is a whole other experience of proving my Jewish, because I qualify for a Jewish passport, which makes me a domestic player because my dad's family is Jewish. So something else that, you know, at some point I'll talk about is the process of proving to the Israeli government that I am actually Jewish, or at least Jewish enough under the right of return to be Israeli.
If that's not a teaser, then I don't know what is. I can't wait to read the story. All right.
Yeah.
Well, Bobby,
it is a little concerning when you sign up to be. Yeah, it's a little concerning when you sign up to be Israeli. What happens if they go to war? If all of a sudden you're drafted into the Israeli army, I had to ask a few people to figure out what. But you know, that's all for another day. We'll get to that.
Wait, did you get like a clear answer, or are you going to be like in fatigue sometime soon?
The general answer is I didn't get the Israeli passport. We have it already. Whenever I go to sign, we'll do it. But basically the answer is because I don't speak Hebrew and I'm like a little old. Like, you're 27. You're too old. Like, first of all, guys, I'm like, you know, just getting to my prime here.
I'm in really good shape. What are you talking about?
But yeah, the general sense is like you won't get called up unless we have every country around us attack us again. I'm like, guys, that happens to you like once every 5 or 6 years.
Right. Yeah.
I mean,
so Bobby,
so that was a catch.
How did you stay in shape and like, were you training while you were there or just like playing pickup games? How did that work?
I probably can't go into that.
Okay. Top secret. Yeah. Okay.
I will say as a professional, the single worst thing as a professional is staying fit on your own, which I did a little bit. Obviously I've had to do over the last couple months being out of contract. But, you know, I could write a book on the misery of having to wake up and go run fitness on your own.
Oh, man. Good read. Can't wait for that one to come out. Bobby, let's get to the next segment. We have this really great conversation lined up with Brett Forrest, who wrote or co-wrote ESPN the Magazine's story on the FBI investigation into FIFA this week. And I can tell everybody, because we already recorded it, that it's really good. So you're going to want to stick around. And we have the return of Tiki Taka this week. Tiki Talka, where we're going to talk about things that we like. So stick around for that, too. I think mine is pretty fun. So coming up, Brett Forrest talking with me and Bobby about FIFA, the FBI, all that good stuff. Chuck Blazer. Oh, man. Stay tuned. A while back, we had Brett Forrest on the show to talk about his book, The Big Fix, The Hunt for the Match Fixers Bringing Down Soccer. And now we welcome him back to discuss his story in this week's issue of ESPN the Magazine, for which he is a senior writer. And the story provides the most detail I've seen into the FBI's investigation of FIFA. Brett, the game has been pretty good to you, hasn't it?
You mean the bad part of the game has been good to me? Yeah, it has been. A lot of interesting stuff to write about there.
So tell us about, okay, I want to ask you so many questions about this, but and I recommend that everyone hit pause right now and go read the piece. It's not super long, but it's so much more detailed than anything else I've seen. But here's my question for you. Chuck Blazer, you know, used his knowledge of accounting. You say he had a degree in accounting to accumulate all this ill-begotten wealth, but then he didn't pay taxes beginning in 2005, which seems like a really, you know, it just seems like odd behavior for someone who knows they're committing financial crimes. How do you explain that?
That would seem to be a glaring accounting error, wouldn't it? before I answer that, I just wanted to make it clear that, you know, I co-wrote this story with Sean Assail, who's also a senior writer at the magazine, with reporting help from Vivek Chowdhury, who's a longtime footballer or soccer expert in the UK. Anyway, just wanted to get that out there because it was a heavy reporting load that we all lifted together, and I think it came together nicely in the end. But back to your question.
I want to get into that. I want to get into how you guys reported this. But let's hit Blazer first. I mean, what is going on with this?
That's something that we discussed more than a few times. How does this guy who enters the FIFA Exco and immediately rises to the upper echelon because of his deal making abilities? How does this guy, who's so smart and so savvy, and you're right, has an accounting degree, how does this guy just forget to pay taxes for year upon year? And the best, we never got an answer to that question, but the best thing we could come up with is, was it a cry for help? This was a guy. Now keep in mind, he stopped paying taxes a little bit later in his scheme. So he was paying taxes early on. I think things just got totally out of control for this guy. He was just living this crazy nightlife, excessive sort of bon vivant. I mean, the guy's 400 pounds. He's just eating nonstop, drinking. He's got a lot of women, just endless nights at the strip club. I think he just spun out of control. That's the only thing I can come up with.
Well, you know, reading this, you really become aware. I mean, it was clear, I think, when these headlines were coming out, when he and Jack Warner sort of turned on each other, I think people were sort of licking their lips thinking, well, now some interesting things are going to come out. But you really get the sense reading your story that he was sort of the author of his own downfall in a sense. I mean, he had some, just sort of psychological thing where he had to get Warner or something like that. You know, you detail this phone call he makes to Jerome Valk in Switzerland at like 3 a.m., right, when Valk picks up. And you tell the story of Mohammed bin Hammam, who was running to become the president of FIFA back in 2011. He went to meet with Jack Warner in Trinidad, and he gave these bribes of $40,000 in cash in these brown envelopes, you say, to Caribbean delegates. And when Blazer hears about it, he's just incensed, and he calls Valk, and he's just ranting at 3 a.m. Was he upset that the bribery was so brazen and that it might bring it all crashing down, or was he upset that he wasn't cut into the deal himself?
I think it was a little bit of a combination of the two, but with a little bit more necessary understanding there. He was, the fact that it was so brazen and that it was about to come out keep in mind that Blazer was the right-hand man of Warner in CONCACAF. So he knew that when this came out, it was going to jeopardize their position there. It was going to jeopardize his position. It was going to jeopardize the entire CONCACAF organization. Okay? So the fact that it had come out and it was beginning to come out kind of forced his hand a little bit. And it made him make a decision to save himself. Right? So that's easily understandable. The other half of the equation, which you said, you know, about not being cut in on the deal, he and Warner had been dealing with kickbacks between them for a long time. Now, the biggest kickback that's been uncovered is the $10 million payment that FIFA brass engineered for the South African delegation to receive the right to host the World Cup.
Right.
So that $10 million, which is a good chunk of change, went into Jack Warner's bank accounts in the Caribbean. And the understanding was that Blazer was going to get $1 million of that. And Warner didn't want to give it to him. And Warner dragged his feet on it. And it's not like Blazer could go to a court of law and sue the guy. I mean, this whole thing is dirty dealing. So it took him a long time, and Warner started to pay out piecemeal. Initially, he said, "Hey, buddy, sorry, I spent that money already." But Blazer pushed. Eventually, he got a little bit at a time. At least one occasion, Warner sent a guy with a paper check up to New York. He lands at Kennedy. He goes to Blazer's office, and Blazer like deposits the check. It was at that level. So I think Blazer at some point felt like he was on the outside looking in at some of these really lucrative bribery schemes.
Bobby, I can imagine that you as a player who, you know, I would imagine has made around $40,000 for a season before, read about these bribes, and I just can't imagine what goes through your head.
That's my big question. Did you get the sense that there is any guilt amongst these guys, that they were like tainting the world's game and that like had a burden on their soul?
No, not at all. I mean, these guys they're proud of, I don't know, how crafty they've become.
Well, I mean, look at the blog. The blog was amazing. The blog was amazing, right?
Yeah. I mean, on his blog, he's doing these little write-ups about all the famous people he's hanging out with. And you see pictures of Blazer with Nelson Mandela on a private plane.
A private jet.
Bill Clinton. And you're like, wow, who is this guy? I mean, one of the jokes was, he used to hang out at Elaine's, which closed not too long ago on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, which was the big hangout for cops and writers and actors and, you know, all sorts of cross section of New York celebrity. And Blazer was a big guy there. And one of the jokes was people said, yeah, we knew he was a big guy at FIFA, but we didn't know what FIFA was.
Yeah.
So you see in these pictures everywhere, you have all these super famous people, and you're like, who's that very large guy standing next to him?
Did you get the sense, like, what redeeming qualities does Blazer actually have? Like, what was his distinguishing advantage that made him this guy?
He was a good deal maker. He could make money and make it quickly. And I think at FIFA, at the Exco, let's back up for a second. He started out with smaller soccer organizations, eventually, you know, landing the job as number two at CONCACAF. When he did that, CONCACAF was filled with a lot of old people who had been sitting in their chairs for a long time, just raking in whatever cash was coming to them. When he got there, he was still relatively young, and he had all this energy, all these new ideas to take this moribund organization and make it into something that could really churn out a lot of money. And then when he made it to the Exco at FIFA, he did the same thing. Because a lot of those guys, I mean, they're at an advanced age. They have very little energy. They've already worked out their schemes. They're making whatever money they're making. When Blazer showed up, he said, guys, we're using a German company to sell our marketing rights. Why? We should sell them ourselves. Why are we going through middlemen to do all these things and giving them fees? We have to maximize things. You know, Blazer started the Gold Cup. So he was the guy who could look at the big picture and say, we can make a lot more money here together.
I want to ask you about the investigation. You say that you know, these investigations by the FBI usually wrap up between, you know, a year or maybe 18 months. Why were these investigators, and we should name them, there's Berryman, right, for the IRS, and there is Randall for the FBI. Why were they allowed to spend more time on this than they might normally get to?
Well, let's back up for a minute. So the case started with a guy named Michael Gaeta, who was the head of the European Organized Crime Division at the FBI's field office in Lower Manhattan. It started with him. He's a senior guy, and this guy named Jared Randall, who was in his late 20s at the time, who had only been at the FBI for a year and a half. So it started with the two of them. They worked it for quite a while. And then Steve Berryman, who was an IRS investigator in Orange County in California, he joined up. And then later,
he sounds like a charming guy, by the way. I mean, just
Berryman,
just the way you portray his sort of entry into the story is fantastic.
Yeah, well, you know, he read about it in the Independent. He read an article in the Independent, which is a UK paper, that mentioned that the FBI was looking into FIFA, but there wasn't a whole lot more there. And you know, Berryman was, you know, he was a soccer nut. And he saw this, and he realized that with his background, he'd been at the IRS a long time, and he worked out of an IRS office that specialized in foreign corruption. So he realized he had this expertise in tracking money through the international financial system that he could apply to a thing he was really interested in, which was soccer, because he'd been brought up for a time in the UK, and he called the FBI guys in Manhattan out of the blue and said, I want in. So it was basically these three guys. A fourth guy joined later, John Penza. He joined with the FBI. And these four guys went at this thing. But I think your original question was why did it take so long?
Well, no, why were they given such a long leash, I guess, to go out and do this? I mean, I think it has to do with Loretta Lynch, maybe. She provided some cover for them.
That's right. It's a good read on it. At that point, Loretta Lynch was the U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of New York, which is located in Brooklyn. And they're the ones who eventually took the FBI's results and turned it into an indictment and a case. You're right. The FBI case is a really long one. It's usually like a year and a half. And when they're hitting up against that, usually prosecutors and supervisors are saying, okay, guys, you got to wrap this one up. This case was unique because, number one, there was an understanding from the supervisors at the FBI and prosecutors across the river in Brooklyn that this is a very complicated international case with people that we may indict residing in a dozen or more countries. So there are two things they had to tackle. One is, of course, the FBI has to gather enough evidence to bring an indictment. The second thing is, just logistically, how do you go about arresting these people? Where you know, because you want to kind of do it all on the same day, but where are they going to be? And then also the Department of Justice has to go to these various governments and work things out, because the FBI can't just arrest people in foreign countries. You know, you got to, the local police has to do it. So, and then how do you extradite people? So there's a ton of DOJ paperwork that had to be done. There was a lot of stuff in the story that we didn't mention in the story. For example, Eric Holder, who was attorney general at the time, having phone calls with the Swiss attorney general on a secret phone line, you know, like a year and a half before the arrests were made in May of last year. So a lot of logistical stuff had to happen. And just lastly, the FBI in Manhattan, they wanted to indict in 2013. But it took another 2 years, really, for the logistical part to come together for DOJ.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, let's turn from that to your process. You had a small team with ESPN.
Yeah.
Looking into this, how did it start for you? Can you tell us as much as you can about how you worked your sources? I think this is really fascinating for people who maybe will read the story, but want to know a little bit about what went on behind the scenes for you guys to actually make it happen.
Right. Well, you know, I was actually in the Middle East on another story, and I was in Qatar, and I heard from my editor that there was that they were getting the gears going on this FIFA thing, and I said, you know, I think, tell me more about it, because I think I have something to offer Sean Assale, who I mentioned earlier, he was a longtime ESPN investigative reporter. He was leading the project, and I, you know, he's an old friend of mine, and we started talking, and I realized that Sean had great access to the Chuck Blazer story. Sean is from Westchester, where Blazer had lived. Sean's father had gone to the same high school as Blazer. They had a lot of stuff that sort of overlapped, and he had a lot of good sources in the area that could help fill out the Blazer story. Another guy we brought on, who's not an ESPN staffer, but his name's Vivek Chowdhury, and he is a longtime UK football expert, a writer and reporter over there. So he brought a lot of the sort of FIFA exco knowledge and sourcing to the table. What I could bring is my set of FBI contacts in international law enforcement, such as Interpol. And it just so happens that I was meeting with people, you know, who were working on the FIFA case. I met with them several years before the indictments came down, and I knew that something big was coming. And they were very close to giving us an exclusive on the whole case before the initial arrests were made. But there was, and we kind of went down the road with them a little bit on that. But eventually there was a high-level Department of Justice decision made, like, okay, we're not going to do that. We're going to handle this differently in the media. So we didn't get that chance, but I think, you know, we wanted to make up for that with this story because we had really good sourcing. And, you know, I was able to speak directly with people who were involved in the case, people who had intimate knowledge of the case, and piecing that inside FBI narrative together with what Sean knew about Chuck Blazer and his associates, and what Vivek could find out about Exco and inside European football. You know, we were able to put together this unique piece.
I guess my big overarching question that you may not be able to answer, but I want to ask you anyway, about FIFA is all these people, all these guys, using it to their own advantage to make a ton of money. Why don't they just make that their business model? Why don't they just like open up a bidding war for the World Cup every 4 years and just sell it to the highest bidder and do it, like, just make as much money as they are now, just transparently?
So you want them to just sell it?
Well, I mean, they're doing that now.
You're making me feel good about being a partner in this with you, George.
But they're doing it now. Like, what I'm asking is, why not just do it, transparently, so that they can keep this money and they're not breaking any laws, and they're, you know, because they have a product that people want. They could sell this product legitimately.
Yeah, yeah, they could. I mean, yeah, I don't know. I think you raise an interesting point.
I never thought of it like that.
But I mean, I guess they'd have to lose their their charitable designation.
Well, that's what I was going to say. That's what I was going to say.
Come on,
I mean, look,
how much is that worth, really?
They're registered as a charity, and that, what does that give them? That gives them, I guess, a tax exempt status. But it gives them much more than that. It gives them this veneer. How many times have you seen video or photos of Sepp Blatter in a third world environment where he's got a pair of, you know, novelty scissors in his hands, and he's cutting the ribbon on some new school or stadium or soccer field, right?
Yeah, Sepp loves those
Sepp,
photo
op. Sepp loves Sepp. Sepp loves pictures of Sepp in Africa or East Asia opening a school for impoverished children, which is great. But that's window dressing for the real business of FIFA, which, as we've come to learn, is, you know, a lot of back, you know, underhanded deals and backroom deals. And
Brett,
I think it would be too much. It would be a step too far if they just said, you know what, we're throwing off this cloak and we're just gonna be what we are.
You talk about how the people that originally got into this were the organized crime unit. Did you get the sense that this felt like a mafia? Is it just a bunch of dudes like trading money and doing bribes? Or did you feel like this was like an intricate network of mafioso kind of stuff?
Well, you know what? It's not so important what I think. It's important what the FBI and the Department of Justice thinks. And it was always fascinating to me because the people who led this case, for example, I mentioned in the story Michael Gaeta, who was the head of the European OC group. He spent 13 years investigating the Genovese crime family in New York City, just on one family. And he built his career on that. He made a lot of good cases, convictions. And the prosecutors that he worked with in the Eastern District of New York, they, you know, in that office, they also have an organized crime office that prosecutes specifically organized crime cases. Now, the people that we spoke to in the FBI and the DOJ who were involved in this said, this looked, this, to us, this looked like an organized crime case. It looked like the sort of thing that we usually did. It involved paying up, you know, like it was all about paying bribes up through the stream, all the way to the top. So,
you know, like, when I think about it, I'm like, yeah, he's a bunch of dudes who like strip clubs, they eat a lot. Like, they're not particularly smart guys who can build this big network. It's just like they have the opportunity and people hand them bags with money and they take it.
I'm pretty sure, though, for this to be a mafia story, they need nicknames, and I'm not sure they had. Did you uncover any nicknames for Chuck Blazer in your reporting, Brett?
Well, you know, we may have come up with a few ourselves, which I can't
Chucky,
share with
Chucky
you.
Walnuts. Chucky Walnuts. Okay.
Well, I guess my auxiliary to that is, did you ever feel scared at any point reporting this? Like, when you're talking about people potentially taking away millions of dollars from them, were you like, oh, shit, like, somebody might kill me?
No. These are not violent people. These are bureaucrats. These are white collar criminals. These are not physically violent, dangerous people.
Yeah, Brett's not building a stadium in Qatar. He's fine. So Brett, I'm sure that as you were reporting, you were working all kinds of sources, people who maybe didn't make it into the story, but you spoke to. What kind of assistance did you get from U.S. Soccer? And I ask because, you know, Blazer has a long history with the U.S. Soccer Federation. You know, they're in the same country as CONCACAF headquarters. And we haven't heard a bunch from them, you know, which on the one hand makes sense because it's an ongoing investigation. On the other, I'm just curious what kind of assistance they gave you.
We can't really divulge a lot of that.
Say it. If I told you, I'd have to kill you.
You know, but what I can say, we did get some assistance. Let me think about the right way to answer that. I mean, one reason why there isn't a lot of that stuff in the story is because we chose to focus in a different area. We didn't feel like U.S. soccer was, in the crosshairs here. That hadn't been shown in the indictments. We were going after the larger narrative.
I'll put you on the spot and I'll ask if you think that U.S. soccer is at fault here and should be held accountable for anything. If they should have known, if they did know. And I know it's a hard question for you to answer, but I think it's important.
But I think you gotta ask another question. Should have known what? Responsible for what exactly?
criminal wrongdoing under their nose. You know, the old thing that when the assistant coach does something wrong, the head coach should have known. You know, it's on your watch. You
sure,
should have known.
Yeah. I totally agree with that premise. You know, Chuck Blazer was not an official with U.S. soccer. I mean, Sunil Gulati was his protege at one point, and there has been some focus on him and some thought about, you know, was there anything going on there? Any involvement? I know that Sunil Gulati's name comes up in the FBI's case file on this, but that, you know, I don't want to cast aspersions here. It doesn't mean that he's a target. It may very well mean that he's been cooperating with the FBI on this. I can't say that for sure, but it's not as if the FBI hasn't looked in certain areas. And keep in mind, when they initially looked at this case, they said, man, this is, how are we ever going to go at this? When they first realized that FIFA was an organization built on bribes and fraud, they said, how are we going to go at this? What did they say? What was the answer to them? They said, there's this guy, Chuck Blazer, and he's just up the street from us. So for them, it was a matter of low-hanging fruit. So I think if U.S. soccer, if there was something glaring there, the fact that it's close by in the United States would mean that the FBI would definitely go after it. Now, this case is still happening. It's still going on. We might see things that will surprise us. But, you know, until we have some proof, I don't really see anything there.
Brett, I got the sense that Blazer had this, you know, you quote him in that, in the hotel in London saying, telling his friend, I'm going to get the bastard, right? Which is, to me, that was kind of a shocking thing to read him saying, because he is one of the bastards that he's talking about. And it seemed to suggest that he had this sort of change of heart where he really was almost wanted to crusade against his former, you know, FIFA comrades rather than just be this pawn that the FBI was using to get to them. Is that, did you get that sense that he sort of was able to sort of like go through that mind trick to where he was now the good guy?
Well, no, it's really easy to understand, quite honestly. What happened was, after Warner and Ben Hammam had been, had pulled their scheme in Trinidad with the $40,000 bribes, Blazer acted as sort of a whistleblower relating to that. Okay, and what happened? That Warner was banished from the game. Ben Hammam was banished from the game. These were two of the most powerful guys in all of international soccer, and Blazer had helped kick them out. So that spurred a backlash internally at FIFA, where a lot of people, a lot of officials were angry with Blazer, and they turned their backs on him, and then they started to actively campaign for his removal from the Exco. So that's where that's coming from. So Blazer's, at that point, is saying, you know, these guys, I made them so much money, and I did the right thing here, and now they're trying to get rid of me. I'm going to get them. And they don't even know that I'm wearing a wire, those idiots. So he was motivated to get them. So when you look at it in that way, it's easy to understand.
You know what's crazy about this whole thing? I remember this today. So I didn't realize that the investigation started that far back, right? 2011.
2010,
yeah. So in 2012, I was at this event. It might have been 2011, but in 2012, I was at this event.
Was Blazer taping you?
So here's the thing. I was in the West Village. Grant Wall was doing this like Q&A sort of thing on a stage in a small venue in the West Village. And I showed up and I'm in the back. I'm just standing there. I got there a little late. And he's taking questions at the end. And I said, hey, Grant, so, you know, we didn't have Howler then. We were setting it up. I didn't have like a venue really to ask these questions myself. But I said, hey, so, you know, everyone thinks that CONCACAF is corrupt, FIFA's corrupt, and yet Chuck Blazer lives right here in New York City, and has anyone looked into him? And Grant sort of, I remember this so clearly, he sort of looks back, and I didn't know Grant at all then, and he said, you know, it's funny you ask that. Chuck's right here in the audience in the front row. And I was like,
no.
Yeah. And I was just like, and that's where the question died. He didn't really answer it. But,
no
it was,
way.
Yeah. I hadn't really thought back to that until this morning, and it was,
oh boy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I guess I'd like to take credit along with the FBI. You know, it's like, I'm just going to take a little credit there for being honest.
I think you brought down FIFA, didn't you?
Yeah. I think
it's you. You're to blame.
I think you might need to in the book version, I'm available. Just letting you know.
That's a good scene. I wish we'd known that scene. That would have been interesting to incorporate.
Yeah, it was just a funny memory. But yeah, listen, this was so great. Is there anything else about this story that we didn't ask you about that you thought was interesting that you wanted to tell the audience?
Oh boy, there's so much interesting stuff here. And keep in mind that our story ended up being, I think, maybe 5,500 words. I mean, that doesn't even come close to getting all the stuff that we had, that, you know, a lot of the juicy material.
I got the sense reading it as an editor that there were things, especially in like sort of Blazer's rise to prominence, that were cut out for length, but that were probably pretty interesting.
Oh yeah. There was a lot of interesting stuff about him and how he, he worked at his father's candy store. He came from very modest background, and he really used soccer through his involvement with his son's youth teams to, he recognized that, as a lot of people did, you know, I mean, I keep making digressions here, but you think back to when Pelé came over and played with the Cosmos, right? Back in the 70s, people said, okay, now the world's game is going to take root here and it's going to be huge in the world's largest market, right? Never happened, right? But Blazer, or at least it didn't happen until much later, Blazer was one of these people who believed in it, who saw this opportunity, who saw this weird situation. World's largest sort of marketing opportunity, world's largest sport. Why aren't these two things coming together? And, that's really where it began for him in suburban New York, just coaching his son's little soccer team. And Blazer had no background in the game. He saw it as a business opportunity from the very beginning. So yeah, there are a lot of interesting details about his early steps in the game and missteps and then how he eventually focused on CONCACAF as an outsider, and he infiltrated it and helped take it over with Jack Warner, and that really shot him up to the top of the global
game. When you take a step back and look at the shape of this story, the whole thing, it strikes me as just kind of amazing that the United States plays such a big role in both, like, you know, the sort of the cancerous heart of world soccer and also yeah. like the attempt to clean it up, right? Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, it's what do people say when they look at this case? What are some of the things most people say? One of the things people say is, well, why is the United States looking into this? Like, it has nothing to do with soccer. And why is the FBI, why are they spending all this time and energy and taxpayer dollars? Why are they why aren't they investigating Wall Street? And look, I mean, we all know that people at the Department of Justice, prosecutors, FBI, they're all human. They want to make careers. They want to make big cases that make a big splash. That's definitely part of it. But, look, there are laws on the books. Do you want to enforce the laws? Seems here that laws were broken when you're talking about running bribe payments through U.S. bank accounts, when you're talking about not paying taxes, when you're talking about soliciting kickbacks for TV and marketing rights for events that take place in the United States. The thing is, where were the Swiss officials all these decades? FIFA is headquartered in Switzerland. Why weren't the Swiss authorities looking into FIFA? Why does it have to be the FBI that looks into FIFA? And the answer is, quite frankly, the FBI is the best at what it does in the world. And it's recognized as such. And America. It has great resources behind it. So, I sit back and ask myself the same questions. Like, why does the FBI have to be the one to clean this thing up? Where are all the other law enforcement agencies around the world that have seen this stuff operating like this in their backyard for decades? I think the proof is in the pudding there.
All right. Well, I'm hoping Loretta Lynch either gets a seat on the Supreme Court or becomes president of FIFA, but we'll see. Brett, thank you for joining us today. I really appreciate your time, and I really appreciate all that you guys did to put this story together. It's really fantastic. Thank you.
Well, I'm really glad that you guys were able to have me on and discuss the story, because I think it's an important one, and especially for your audience. There's a lot more to look into and understand here. So, so go check it out online.
But I want to remind people that your book is called The Big Fix. It's really good. And it's, just sort of another way into a true crime story about soccer, which is really gripping. So go get it. Okay, Bobby, Tiki Taka coming up. What do you have for us this week?
So, George, everyone's talking about the Messi PK, where Barcelona's winning the game, maybe 4-1 at that point. He runs to take the PK, and instead of shooting, he like touches it 1 yard to the right, and Suarez comes in and smashes it home.
Yes.
And everyone's like, oh, Barcelona, they're so baller, they're awesome. And then they're talking about how it might have been like an ode to Johan Cruyff, who's recently kind of sick. And, it was cool, and maybe it was baller, but I can tell you, if I was in that game, I'm not going to tell you what would have broken Messi's leg, But I just have no idea how that goes unpunished. You know, like we were playing like a random, a random pickup game a few months ago, and my team got smashed. Like, we're doing best of seven. We lost 4-0 in the fourth game. I think I lost like 5-0 in a 7-minute game. Totally deserved to lose. But in the last game, a guy like dribbles around our goal, gets on his knees and heads it in. And there's like 20 seconds left in the day. And I literally, like, I fouled him with the full intent of ending his life. This is the kind of thing I struggle about as a professional. Like, is that right or wrong? But to me, like, as a pro, and I get that soccer is an entertainment business, but what Messi did, to me, is, like, totally disrespectful. You know, I guess it's cool. I guess there's entertainment value to it. But it's just, you know, from a professional standard, you don't do that if it's a close game. You don't do that if you're a little arrogant.
Okay, a couple of questions, okay? This is interesting. This is bringing up a few thoughts in my head because, A, I have in the last issue, we published a story about the guy who says he invented it. I've seen since that there might be some, you know, that someone in, I think, Ireland or Scotland might have done it like 2 months earlier, but Rick Coppens for Belgium back in like the 60s did this, right? So, but the other thing that I am thinking about is I was recently watching a game from like 76, right? And it's my dad playing with the Rowdies against the Cosmos, Pelé, Canalia, all those guys. And one thing that he had told me about this game before I watched it was in the first minute, Pelé comes in and just takes out Rodney Marsh, like totally takes him out. And that was because a month earlier, the Rowdies had beaten the Cosmos 5-0 in Tampa. And at one point, Rodney had gotten the ball, knelt down behind it, and spread his arms wide open to the guy who was marking him, basically just to say, like, come and get it, right? And so it's super, super disrespectful. And my dad he said, look, you don't disrespect a fellow professional like that. And so that was Pelé's response. And everyone on the field knew exactly what it meant and why he did that. And so talk a little bit about this code of sort of ethics and conduct among professionals and like why you feel that it's really bad to embarrass another player like that, like you think Messi did.
And so I don't have a good answer, man. And this is the kind of thing it literally keeps me up at night. Like, I didn't sleep that night because I didn't know if what I did was right or wrong. But to me, like, to be the best you can be, especially sports are angry, right? Like, we can call it a beautiful game, but sports involve testosterone and adrenaline and anger. And to me, you've got to be like all in or not. And if I feel a little disrespected, if I feel a little like you're taking the piss out of me and sticking up your middle finger like you're better than me, that I can't stand for that. Because if I give you an inch, ultimately you're going to take a mile. So I don't know the right code. And I think a lot of guys disagree with me. A lot of guys think there's beauty in that. You should enjoy yourself. It's just not the way I view the game.
Why did you think that Messi's penalty kick was disrespectful?
Because you wouldn't have done it if in a close game. They don't do it if they're like riding high, feeling good about themselves. It's something they did because they could.
What about, you know, a Panenka? Is a Panenka different for you?
I think a Panenka, for the most part, is like an effective penalty kick. But yeah, there's definitely times when it's the person being a bit of a dick.
Yeah, but so isn't a two pass penalty kick also a pass penalty kick? Isn't that also effective? It's like a trick.
Maybe.
I guess tricks. People are skeptical of tricks, right? I mean, they think that they're dirty or, you know, underhanded, but
and I think maybe at times that this two pass penalty for Barcelona was clearly like, watch what we can do.
Yeah, yeah, huh? Interesting.
And people might disagree, but for me, and like I think players like me who often play in this like idea of responsibility and discipline and accountability, you know, I think it struck a chord.
You know that Pires and Henri tried it for Arsenal, and
he tried to roll it.
Yeah,
that's one of the great fails in her human history.
Yeah, I think that's like the upside to the other team is like, well, you might score on us, make us look silly, but that might happen too. So it's a risk.
Yep.
All right, that was interesting. I kind of want to explore this a little more, like the unwritten code of conduct among professional athletes and what is acceptable and what isn't. You know, because you see a lot of showboating that people don't seem to mind. You see, you know, Ronaldo like acting like a, you know, like he just walked on the moon after he scores a goal and nobody seems to, you know, whatever. Right. But that seems to rile you up. It's interesting. Okay. My Tiki Talk of this week is a game that happened in Australia. Gold Coast City went down 6-1 against the Holland Park Hawks. Somehow they come back in the 70th minute. It's 6-1. Somehow they come back and they tie the game. They take it to overtime and end up winning 8-6. It's really amazing. I don't know what competition this is. It's called the BLK Silver Boot. And I think these are two amateur teams, but it's hard to tell. They might be just high-level amateur teams. They might be some kind of semi-pro outfits. I'm not really sure, but it's amazing, and you can see the highlights. It's 10 minutes of highlights, but it's like goal after goal after goal on our show page, howlermagazine.com/podcast. It's right there. Okay, this is the end of the show, but I still have to read you two poems. Don't stop the podcast until you've heard these two poems. These are the winners of our Valentine's Day poetry contest. We held it with World Soccer Shop and sent two people two sets of jerseys, one for them, one for someone they like a whole lot. And the first winner was Irene Ho. She wrote, "Roses are red, violets are blue, Neuer is fit, and much like his concept of goalkeeping, my love for him transcends the conventional boundaries of poetic structure." Very clever, Irene. Thank you. Next one is from Posting Out, not really a person, more like a Twitter account, an Instagram account. Here we go. At Posting Out writes, "So out of my league, you give me a Rabona. I long for your hand, my dearest Maradona." I really liked that one when it came in. Very clever. Anyway, you guys are both great, and you're both in Texas. That's kind of weird. I didn't realize we had such a following there. But hey, whatever, I'll take it. That's great. I want to thank somebody special today. Ryan Catneys has been our producer for like the last more than a year. I don't know, a long time. 2 years? It's been a while. Ryan recently got a real full-time job in Miami with BeIN Sports. Very happy for him. But he's very busy. He's moving on. And we have three replacements. You've heard me say their names before. Faisal Sikdar, Nick Jansen, and of course, Wes Burdine taking over full-time for Ryan. But I hear that Ryan lost a bet, and so he has to actually edit this last episode. So thank you, Ryan. I want to thank Brett Forrest, of course, and Bobby Warshop coming on. I'm a little bummed that Bobby didn't tell the whole story about his Israel trip, but I have seen a draft of what he's writing about it, and it's well worth the wait. So we'll tell you where to read that when it becomes available. My name is George Qureshi. I will be back next week with the rest of these dummies. And until then, remember that when you listen to Dummy, you will never listen alone.